Mini episode 301 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Pleasure to have all of you joining us here today for FDH Lounge mini episode number 301, and it's going to be a tremendous pleasure to speak to this gentleman. We've been cutting a swath through the New York-based media, purely on the sports side alone. Tom Verducci, Neil Best, Evan Roberts, Rick Wolf, Teddy Atlas, Len Robbins, Christopher Russo, Sam Rosen, Ian Eagle, four times with Kenny Albert, and of course, a couple fellows that have become cast members of ours, good friends that have joined the show, Steve Callis and Lloyd Carroll. We're adding a really great name to our list of New York sports media guests today here on the show where nothing is off topic. True pleasure to have on this gentleman. He has been covering the NFL for a long, long time for Newsday. Also now is with NBC Sports. And again, his reporting, his columns are consistently excellent. And if you want to get a good read on what's going to happen in the 2013 NFL season, this is a good gentleman to do it with. Specifically, Bob Glauber joining us here today on the FDH Lounge. Bob, welcome to the program, sir. Pleasure to have you.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here, especially after that introduction. I got to tell my wife about that stuff. That's nice, well, man. I got to tell her, hey, somebody thinks I'm all right.
I'm glad you like it. We try to put everybody pretty strong on the show. Your time is probably tight. I know you're calling us from the press box at the Rich Kotite Bowl there with the Eagles and the Jets. So I will respect your time and hopefully not keep you too long. I want to ask you, you had tweeted about this afternoon. This is the hot breaking news as we're taping this. The NFL concussion settlement. And again, we're only on the leading edge of what's being reported about it in the first several hours. Do you get a sense that there may be any kind of media overreach in terms of the reporting of it, of, oh, this is all behind the NFL now, leaving aside the fact that there's that very serious lawsuit still pending against the helmet manufacturers?
Well, I think it's two separate deals. I think the NFL is absolutely breathing a sigh of relief over this ruling. Now, the Riddell and other manufacturer lawsuits do go on, and so that is absolutely a thorny issue, but this was a big one, and, you know, people were claiming existential threats to the NFL based on the potential damages that the league could have been liable for had this gone to trial and had juries, you know, ruled in favor of the players. So you were talking billions and billions of dollars in potential damages, and now you're talking about a fixed sum of $765 million, which comes out to about $24 million per team. One shot done, and they have this in the rearview mirror. So I think that, you know, while the players get, you know, listen, I'm not in a position to be a judge of, hey, was this a great deal for the players or not? This is a multi-billion dollar industry, and did they settle for a little bit less? Well, in every settlement, you probably sell for a little bit less, but in the players' minds, they got needed money to address their problems right here and right now, as opposed to having this drag on for what would have been a number of years. I mean, the appeals for this kind of litigation would have gone on for years, if not a decade or so. So they get the money now, and the NFL at least has some closure on this issue, which was absolutely a threat to the bottom line.
Oh, very well said. Yes, there's always trade-offs. You're absolutely right whenever you're bypassing court proceedings and everything. So certainly there was some give and take on both sides. To the concrete issue of somebody actually taking on an injury, even if it wasn't a serious long-term head injury as some of these ones are, the Mark Sanchez situation there this past weekend, the controversy of him being in there in the fourth quarter. I read your column, and it was kind of enlightening when you were talking about Phil Sims having played deep into games previously and even in the fourth preseason game. What I couldn't tell from your column, and so I'm guessing Phil probably didn't indicate one way or another to you, but do you know if he was playing with the third and fourth team in there, or did he have his first team blockers with him in there when he was going deep into the game?
You know, that's a good question, and I should have mentioned it in there, but he, you know, this was in the days when the NFL played their starters most of these games to really get them ready for the start of the season. The thinking among the coaches was, well, you got to get them battle-tested as much as you can early on, and you don't play them early in the preseason. You don't play them much. Give them a series or two in the first couple of games. You ramp it up a little bit more in the third, and then that fourth one, it's kind of the springboard into the regular season, and that's when you're playing. And Phil Simms, he was talking about a game in 1987. He said, I can remember that like it was yesterday. I played the entire game. I even played the overtime. Well, there was not an overtime in that game, but he was correct that he did play the entire game and won it with a touchdown pass to Lionel Manuel, who was a good receiver in his day with the Giants. And I'm looking back on that story. I'm like, oh, my goodness. It is just stunning how different the NFL is now compared to what it was just, you know, 25 years ago. And, you know, now it's like you're lucky if a starter plays a series or two in the fourth preseason game. Coaches generally go into that fourth preseason game saying, all right, we got this far. I don't want anybody else hurt, any key players hurt, so we're not playing them. And that's generally the dynamic pretty much around the entire league right now. And it just was not that way at all 25 years ago. And the point Simms was making to me about, you know, his situation compared to the Jets, at that time last week, the argument was, well, the Jets aren't willing to name a starter, but after the third preseason game, it may go into a fourth. And Simms was saying, well, you know, big deal. I played the entire fourth game. So, you know, what's the harm? And I kind of agreed with him in terms of, what's the harm in waiting a few more days to decide the Mark Sanchez, Geno Smith competition? Obviously, things changed with the Sanchez injury, and that was its own set of circumstances. I thought it was a dumb move for Rex Ryan to put him in at that point in the game.
Oh, truly, and it really goes against the kind of risk-averse culture that we're in and what you were talking about there, about how that's the primary consideration now, it seems, rather than getting players completely ready for the first game of the season. Again, a big, big story in New York, I know, this past week, and some of the other elements out there in the media industrial complex like ESPN have been playing it up pretty big. But again, for folks like myself in flyover country, I'm in Cleveland, Bob. For everybody else, pretty much when we look at the Jets, we just kind of see a bad team. And, you know, there's the Rex Ryan factor. But aside from that, maybe not a whole lot that causes interest to the rest of the country. It really does seem, does it not, this year that the AFC has just about all of the league's real bottom feeders. When you've got the Jets, you got the Jags, you got the Raiders, and it's hard to find a team in the NFC that you would group in with any of those teams, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think even at the top of the AFC, it's not quite as deep as it is at the top of the NFC. You know, these things go in cycles. You have years where the AFC, and a period of years where the AFC is a dominant conference, then you have it swing to the NFC. And this is one of those pendulum swings that really goes toward the NFC. Just a ton of really good teams. And you look at every division, with only a couple of exceptions, and you can make a case that, you know, those races are going to be unbelievable. You look at the NFC South. I mean, if Carolina is a better team, if Tampa plays, you know, like the kind of money that they've invested in their team in the offseason, you know, Drew Brees comes back with Sean Payton. And, oh, by the way, the Atlanta Falcons, who came within a play or two of the Super Bowl, are in that division. That's a great division. The NFC West, all of a sudden, is one of the most compelling divisions in football. Top to bottom in the NFC, it really is strong. And you're right, the weaker, you know, the underlings certainly do seem to reside in the AFC. And I think we have one here in New York in the Jets. I just don't see this as a very good team.
Right. I can't see anybody that would really disagree with you on that point. In terms of assessing the teams in there, some of the powerhouses in the NFC specifically, I'm going to pose a question to you. We've been putting this to a lot of the guests we've had on recently. I have yet to get a dissenting opinion on this from Rick Bucher, Ian Eagle, Evan Roberts. Everybody has agreed with this. Let's see if you continue to make this unanimous. My theory, leader in the clubhouse for a rivalry of the 2010s, Seattle-San Francisco. What say you, Bob?
Love that rivalry, and I will take that. I mean, that rivalry has everything. It has good players on both sides. It has outspoken players on both sides, you know, especially Richard Sherman. He'll be willing to say anything. Mm-hmm. And you have two coaches that, you know, kind of hate each other. They just, Harbaugh and Pete Carroll just do not get along. Going back to their days when Harbaugh was at Stanford and Pete Carroll was at USC, it really is, it's quite fascinating to see that, you know, relationship kind of fester over a period of years. And I go back to, that USC Stanford game a couple of years ago, and they talk after the game. I think Pete Carroll was a little bit upset that Jim Harbaugh ran it up on him. And, you know, Jim Harbaugh says, "Hey, what's your deal?" It's like, wow. And that really has not gotten any better over time, but I think it's added to the spice of that rivalry. That to me is the most, you know, fun and interesting and competitive rivalry that we've got going in today's NFL. I do agree on that.
There's tremendous chemistry between them. Maybe not positive chemistry, but yeah, it almost seems like fate that they end up in the same division and that they have these powerhouse teams going head-to-head with one another. But when you look at that, obviously, they're in the conversation. But who do you see as probably the primary favorites to make it to the Super Bowl in your backyard next February?
Well, I think in the NFC, I'm almost settled on San Francisco going back to the big game and winning it. I think it will come down to between those two teams. I just think right now, and listen, injuries change things. You know, some teams come out of nowhere and, you know, do some things, and the reality changes over the course of a season. But right here, right now, I do like San Francisco to come out of the NFC. And the AFC, I'm telling you, it's really a toss-up. And I'm going back and forth between the Broncos, the Patriots. You know, the Texans, I'm just not sold on Matt Schaub as a championship quarterback. So, I put them in the distant third category. I think the Ravens will be a good team again this year. And the one team that I'm really giving serious consideration to, thinking they're going to be a surprise team playoff-wise, would be Cincinnati. Because I think, you know, if Andy Dalton takes that next step, he's got good skill position players around him. He's got maybe one of the best defenses in football to play opposite. And Mike Zimmer is a terrific defensive coordinator who I think will start to kind of get into that head coaching rotation. I think he'll get his shot next year. Jay Gruden, a good offensive coordinator. So I'm really this close, and it goes against every fiber of my being, having covered the league this long, to pick the Bengals to have a special season. But it's hard for me to look at that roster and not be impressed.
Well, I understand you saying that, Bob, certainly, because the AFC North's right in my backyard, so I understand your perception on that. But what you said is very interesting on a couple of different levels. First of all, about San Francisco, because I agree with that. I picked them to win the Super Bowl, and your NBC Sports colleague, Rick Bucher, when he was on, he said, "I'd like to agree with you being a Bay Area guy," but he said that would be winning the Super Bowl as a Super Bowl loser, which nobody's done since the Dolphins of the early 70s. But I have not been deterred, despite his very good point on that, and I see that you're not either. But as far as it goes with the Bengals and the Texans, we had a recent roundtable on the show where we were breaking down the season, and one of my colleagues made an excellent point here. You've got sort of the one bracket in the AFC with the Patriots and the Broncos, the proven Hall of Fame quarterbacks, and then in the other bracket, it's almost Houston and Cincinnati. Because what you said about Houston and having to prove something, doesn't that go for the Bengals also when you look at that awful playoff performance from Andy Dalton last year against Houston? I mean, aren't they kind of in the same boat as far as those quarterbacks having to step up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I think Dalton, being a little bit of a younger quarterback than Schaub, I think Schaub's had a couple more chances. You know, not many more chances because, you know, Dalton has now been to the playoffs. But I see your point there. I just think the upside for Andy Dalton is a little bit brighter than it is for Matt Schaub. I think Schaub is more of an established product. And, you know, maybe he'll be used to the bright lights this year. Maybe, you know, those big games like the New England game he just did not play well in last year on the big stage. Maybe he'll kind of say, okay, I've got to embrace this. I'm ready for this. I'm ready to take that next step. And if that happens, Houston is absolutely a contender. I mean, the defense with J.J. Watt and Cushion coming back is a legitimately good defense. I just think that the Bengals are a very, very balanced football team. And I know in this day and age, you got to have the quarterback, and offenses generally do great against a kind of a defenseless league that it's become. But the Bengals are that exception with a really, really good defense that can kind of turn games around. And it's good enough that Andy Dalton can kind of be a game manager. And that really is going to be his best advantage there. If that defense can kind of get the short field for the offense, you know, with turnovers and with good stops, then I think it makes the offense's job that much easier. And I think that Dalton will have the benefit of that in most games this year.
Well, it's pretty funny when looking at Cincinnati and Houston, they both got the standout number one wide receivers and then really haven't had a whole lot else the last couple of years. Do you feel like it gives Dalton a leg up possibly if you just look at those two teams there? He now has Tyler Eifert, who looks like he might be the biggest legitimate second threat that either team's had in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think that's a big addition. And I think A.J. Green having more experience is big. I think that, you know, Ben Jarvis, Green Ellis, just having experience there and being with championship caliber teams in New England. They didn't win it all when he was there, but they certainly came close. So I just think there's a good blend of experience. And again, I think that defensive front is very, very good. And I, again, combined with a good solid offense, I don't think you have to be crazy on offense if you're Cincinnati when you have that kind of reliable defense. You know, maybe I'm overstating things. I don't know. But, you know, I think the corners are really solid. I think the defensive line is very good. And it's an emerging linebacker group. So, again, maybe I'm just kind of fixated on it, but I do need somebody to kind of talk me down from it before I actually put this in print. So you can try now. I'm all ears if you're saying you're nuts for even thinking of picking the Bengals to go to the Super Bowl.
No, I think you got to put them in the conversation. I absolutely agree with that. And for as far as it goes with the quarterbacks too, again, when you really look at the powerhouse teams being in the NFC, I mean, I posed this question recently because I picked Houston to come out of the AFC, and somebody was a skeptic about, oh, Matt Schaub, can he go to the Super Bowl? I said, well, how good do you have to be a Super Bowl losing quarterback? Stan Humphries right. took a team to the Super Bowl. So it's kind of another standard, isn't it, when you're looking at a weaker conference?
Yeah, you know, I got Stan Humphries. Man, that's a blast from the past, huh? that's right. Yeah, I mean, I know what you mean. And the point about a Super Bowl loser never going back and winning it is another kind of gives you pause. I do think that, man, you know, Jim Harbaugh just is the kind of coach who just has that will to win so bad, and Kaepernick now really in his first full season as a starter gives him a really good chance. And I just love their defense. They've still got some issues at the corners, but you know, I think they'll rectify that, and it's easier to play corner when you have a good front seven like that. But yes, the thing about the quarterbacks, you can have a nominal quarterback. You can have kind of a not a marginal quarterback, but certainly a quarterback who's not lighting the world on fire to get you to a Super Bowl. I mean, it wasn't all that long ago that Brad Johnson was the quarterback for the Buccaneers when they won the Super Bowl. And there was a lot of conversation then that, oh, wow, maybe you don't have to, you know, get that number one pick and get that top quarterback. Maybe you could just kind of win with a game manager. Well, that talk quickly died out when the Bucs died out, and then really there was a series of Super Bowl winners that included those big-time blue-chip franchise quarterbacks.
Absolutely. That's what the league has become. And, again, Bob, I greatly appreciate you carving out some time to talk to us here on a game day. The conversation, stellar, as I knew that it would be. Appreciate it so much. Love to have you back again sometime, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me. I would love to do it again. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. The great Bob Glauber, everybody, from NBC Sports and Newsday. Thank you all for tuning in. FDH Lounge mini episode number 301.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio. Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.